to meet you. What a wide-ranging sort of insight into all the sort of ducking and weaving and inventing and creating and sidestepping it means to take this, a career as an artist, like many things. I did want to start, but you touched on the end, you talked about, when talking about the design machine, and you latterly said that you had the sketches and the maquettes and the nuggets of ideas. I really would like just a bit more of an insight into that piece, into the ideas of the piece, not just the mechanics of the piece and the fact that it was hard to define, because, of course, not privileged to see it. Yeah. It would be, I don't know what ideas you were playing with, and there must be a whole collection of ideas of your own and ideas that became new out of the collaboration, but I'd really like a seed of a few of those.
You touched on the first question that every journalist asked us, and it's basically, where does it come from? What is this practice? What do you and Helen do? How do you unravel this thing? Where is it starting from? And essentially, we both read a lot. We read a lot of surrealist literature, and we base a lot of the images for the work in forgotten memories of surrealist literature. So it's not like anything describes a whole novel or narrative or arc storyline, but it's usually based on a something. And this is a very specific novel by Angela Carter called The Infernal Design Machines of Dr. Hoffman. And it's about the invasion of a city-state with distorted reality and sexuality and fantasy and dream to a point where it can be completely subsumed. So dystopian fantasy. And so we read that novel. In fact, Helen read that novel and said, we've got to do something about this. I read it. We left it alone for 6 months. So we made some notes, had some ideas. Helen very much works on the physicality and the dramaturgy of the potential of the performance that we'll work with. And I very much focus on the installation, and then we both focus on the site and how those things then meet. But we both have an influence and a dialogue about each other's main focuses, if that makes sense. So,
would you say that you intentionally chose not to have a narrative? So you didn't follow the narrative of the novel, it's an interpretation or a different take, or using it simply as base material to...
It's like a broken crystal. If you take a novel, imagine it's a crystal, you smash it and just picked up some fragments, some fractures of that, and then they cast a new light on this image that we had seen. And for me, the core of this idea of the novel being about this machine that he's using to invade the city-state, I kind of had two thoughts about it. One was either a kind of totally multimedia-based project that used sort of multiple levels of social media platforms to describe distorted narratives that the audience enter into well before they come into a physical space, but they've already kind of had to try and find some journey into its language. And then within that, it was all about motion mapping and complex use of multimedia. Or it was about the beginning of cinema and about a zoetrope. Zoetrope being similar. So, and for me, I wanted to engage, and I do generally like engaging with something that has a manifest build, that it is to do with a kind of craftsmanship and to do with contact with materials. And I understand that does relate into new media, and I do use that field, but actually building something that engages with an audience through their physicality and through physical phenomena, and that tests our performers. So this installation was a 6-metre-high scaffold-based structure that in the middle of it had a suspended series of lines coming to a circular stage that span, that performers stood on, and as it span, it allowed the performers to do extraordinary things with their physicality because of the velocity of its spinning. And the way that it span is they would use the outside, the scaffolding of the stage to spin it. So it was all to do with tension and weight, but it wasn't too heavy to allow the performers to be able to move it themselves. So it was this kind of balance of ergonomics and physicality.
So that's a lovely tension, isn't it? The fascination of making that structure, really exciting structure work, and not losing sight of what it is you're trying to do within that environment, because both are equally fascinating, aren't they, to get those together. How did the audience encounter that? How were they positioned?
So they came into this cylindrical shaft, tunnel shaft, that drops 10 metres from street level through a crawl-in space that high, crawled in onto a scaffold tower that's tethered onto the side of the wall, all within public liability and health and safety and insured, etc. They come down onto a ground level. They're standing on the floor, which is essentially 10 metres below street level. The floor is a 4-inch concrete pad, which is the ceiling of the train line that goes from Rotherhithe to Wapping underneath the Thames. So every 5 minutes, you feel the vibrations of the train going underneath your feet. And we had to build this installation using materials that would fit through this small aperture that the audience crawled through, but also just outside it, to add a little bit of technical difficulty. It was a 6-metre high wall. So despite there being this crawling space that you could get materials into, this high wall meant that crawling space actually had a window that big.
So and the audience came in through there too.
The audience came in, the materials came in. It was a 4-day build and a 4-day extraction.
What, for the audience to get
the audience to get the audience up. But we could only get 100 people in a night. So the audience stood around the installation against the curved walls and between the curved walls of the shaft and the machine, the design machine.
Presumably.
So butted up against it.
That space has a fantastic presence anyway.
Yeah, I mean the shadow fall on as the performance happens, the shadow fall of this of their performance and physicality onto these circular walls around it. That was the zoetrope for me. It was a shadow of that.
And did it feel like a dystopian future or a utopian future?
I think we explored some of that aspect through the costumes. But for me, by that point, it becomes so much about a saturated installation that I didn't feel like I had to describe anything kind of about a grander urban narrative. Just by going into that space, if we put nothing in there, it just sort of does a lot of that.
Do I have any questions?
Use of public space was something that I explored a lot with the Noosphere, that suspended piece. and the value of democracy and use of public space without that becoming criminalised. And engagement with a whole spectrum of ages and cultures and social background. That's a very simplistic answer. That was.
So that's kind of the societal material.
Yeah. So the politicisation of the kitchen table, of medicines and self-healing, use of kind of copyright and genetic materials. So that's kind of some of the imagery going on with that helix of medicinal plants, made into a small grove of trees, apothecary arboretum. some of the issues sort of touched upon in that without trying too hard to stamp it on everybody's foreheads as they went through the installation. And I think that's, for me, the way to approach some of those issues that will have a massive influence in the future of, you know, our individual bodies as well as industrial commerce, about medicine and about what we can do to keep ourselves healthy.
Can you just say a little more about how that piece worked in terms of, you could see physically how it was structured, but how did you start to engage the audience with that?
We did a variety of things. Some of them were very very gentle and poetic. So the guy with the turban on, he was engaging specifically with some of the younger people that came and telling them some of the folklore and fairy tales about those plants. And telling them stories. Some of them that he created himself, some of them from a script that we created together, and some of them that he created with the children and their parents that came along and kind of unraveled. But then part of that process also led to a series of banquets where we ate food that had seeds that we found and could plant and then start a new process of germinating and going from seed to plate, and then that dialogue again of how sustainable that might be in the future, given that there's less and less land in which to do it. So those are kind of different ways of engaging with it. And then also a series of kind of planting propaganda pamphlets that were a bit more hard-hitting and a bit more about...
Were they presented as propaganda?
They were sort of futurist, graphic kind of posters, yeah. And then that kind of crosses over into another collective that I'm part of called Gut Club, which is all about food and the body. And this kind of hard-hitting statements about fast food and slow food, and people noticing what you've become having consumed the fast food. This sort of
so did it really tend to get to the heart of those issues, or did it intend to sort of expand a knowledge, or was it, you know, really focus?
Gut Club's much more provocative. I'd say Artist Gardener, when I do work more in the art realm, is more poetic. Not the issues are any different, really, in many respects, but the approach to them is less hard-hitting.
Do you
quite
mind
aggressive
that?
In some
that's, obviously, you don't mind that. It's all your work, but are you interested in work that has a more an interface of a challenge, or do you like something that's?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I like going. When I go and see work, I like work that's challenging. I also like work that gives me space to think. That isn't so hard hitting, so overwhelming that I don't have space to breathe and think. And that's infrequent now, more and more, because we expect a kind of immersive wraparound experience, whether it's static work or cinema or theatre, but I think that work that allows you to breathe and have your own interpretation, and that's the work that I hope that we make with Arbonauts, that allows a stillness in the audience in which to observe themselves and the work that's unfolding around them. Funnily enough, we're talking about the same stillness in Garden. I'm sort of able to time, different time scale, observation of seasons and cycles. And
It's coming. We have a second question.
You were talking about how the creative work happens at the funding, that a lot of the creative work is in preparing. You have to go through two or three iterations before you get to the actual final, before you get funding. Do you have to compromise, or do you find that the funds actually improve the proposal? I mean, what happens in that process in terms of changing your creative ideas to the finished product?
When you're aware that it's likely proposal will get rejected first time round. that's hard because you know you've got to do it. You've still got to put it in to make the relationship. So there is an awareness about the work in that body, whichever body you're choosing, and especially when it's the first time you've done it. But at the same time, going through that process of refining what that idea is, making it viable on all aspects, financially viable, health and safety viable, promotion viable, documentation, all of those things, all of those different aspects of it. The kind of consolidation of those things through rejection and the rewriting of it means that you've started some of those relationships, you then have to extend them and go deeper into them. Say, okay, well, you were willing to support this corporate, you're willing to support us in that funding bid, we didn't get it. But I think if we do these things, and from our feedback, it looks likely that if we do these things, we will get it next time around. You're committed, they're convinced by our work, let's go for it again. We would need these other aspects from you. It might be an educational program. It might be in-kind support for a use of a property. Those are very specific things that we need. And it does. It does help form what the work is. It helps your confidence in what the work is. You know what it is. But depends on your, for us, the production cycle, actually live making it, is so different from any of that process of writing a funding proposal, that it still gets juicy and fun again. You know, it comes out of that dry, file-based environment and back into a process in which we know some aspects of what the outcome will be, but we don't know how all of those relationships with our creative partners within Arbonauts are going to play out. In this last piece, for instance, we had two young composers involved, Alex and Louise, until the very last week before we went live, and then suddenly realised that when the work was installed, it couldn't take any live voice at all, amplified or unamplified, and we had to shelve, 8 weeks' work with them. It was very, very hard to do because of their long-term working collaboration with them. But it just didn't work. It didn't work for the overall sonic phenomenon of what was going on in that space. So it does mean adaption and an ability to be fleet of foot when it gets into a live environment.
Thank you. I have a question from Sharon.
Yes, who or what is your community? Who or what is your community? You may not be able to answer
that. No, it's an interesting one. That's exactly where I was. Because I took quite a bit of flack within the organisation insofar as I was never interested in appointing Area 10 at Peckham and saying, this is art for Peckham. This is art. And Peckham happens to be where we are. And Peckham engages with it. And we engage with people coming into the building and engaging with the work that we make around the building. But it was more about a social intervention, than it was about taking responsibility for a locality or trying to prove ourselves by running educational programs that engaged with different sectors of that locality. We did do things that engaged with different sectors of the community, the neighbourhood, the borough, but it was very much about making art that wasn't forced to have that social efficacy. It wasn't necessarily engineered. with that at my, I mean, I was, you know, I did a lot of work with the Youth Connection Service, which is a council-run service for young, underprivileged adults. And a lot of the work we did with the Nurseville was to do with that sector. And they ran the Nurseville quite often in public environments, young people who worked with and trained to do the technical aspects of that, to run those conversations. So I've always had a deep interest in that. But as an overall conceit of Area 10, I was interested in it existing and resonating rather than being defined by its locality. And I think post-project, it has become defined by its locality because its locality has changed so dramatically. It's because, you know, that space could not exist even 10 miles from where it is now because that whole area now has such a networked transport communications. It's an investment opportunity. Just as we lost the building, that whole area got all the available property got bought out straight away by venture capitalists, all the larger properties. And it got knocked down within 4 weeks of us moving out of it. It remained knocked down. It's still knocked down behind the Palisade fence. It's still on the market. The council's still trying to shift it, but it's an empty plot, which is much more viable for the council to sell to the developer. And now, my community, as far as the work that we make with Arbonauts, is, I suppose, a cultural, global community. It's what we're trying to build work that will have the possibility of extending our platform beyond London. And that's sort of our strategy, is what we'd like to take the work elsewhere, and like be influenced by practice from elsewhere, and bring that back to London, rather than making it, as we do at present in London, take it out, we'd like to make the work elsewhere, bring it back to London. London's a very competitive environment in which to make work. My understanding of it from the inside is that it may be easier to bring work back to it rather than make the work in it. That makes sense. Questions? The bubble of that sort of energy, especially, I mean, it was a very kind of privileged space. We didn't pay for it. It was massive. We did a lot of work to maintain it. We took all responsibility for the maintenance physically of the fabric of the building, but on top of that, dealing with business rates, for instance, that was my job for 8 years. That was 4 weeks of every year to negotiate business rates. All those aspects. But being in that environment where you could invite someone, either off your own back or based on a proposal, they said we read between 20 and 40 proposals a week often, and take a journey with them where they might be in a completely different place in their practice, they might be mid-career, they might have shown in established institutions. There might be a whole different network of things that you can exchange and play between the dialogue. There's all sorts of really extraordinary opportunities that happen through that, but at the same time, the kind of overall, as it drew to a close, the overall investment of time and energy, I don't know. I really enjoy being focused quite acutely on my own work and where that's going to go and getting a better understanding of that rather than keeping a space open for it to be filled by other people's work. I'd look back at that practice maybe at some point in the future and at having an investment in a space of some sort, or maybe less a space and more a program. Helen and I have been thinking about trying to do a program of events outside of London, sort of setting up a a dialogue, a critical dialogue about site-based performance. I think I'd be very careful about getting involved in bricks. That's somebody else's bricks, isn't it?
Do you have another? I have two questions here. Battled about. Next, your next, Sylvia.
Thinking about areas that you said you didn't really do a lot of your own, I was wondering if you saw it more of like a curating in yourself, maybe not of artwork, but of artists?
Yeah, in some ways I saw the whole environment as an art, not my artwork, but as an evolving artwork. As an ecology, I suppose. And especially kind of like some of the bigger events and characters that we had through the space influencing that and changing it slightly or changing it massively in some cases. So I never really saw myself as a curator. I was interested in its direction, its like its journey as an organisation, as a charity. And I was interested in sort of threads of themes running through it, maybe running through some of the seasons, but it was more about an overall direction of it rather than a kind of critical curatorship of it.
Thank you. Sylvia has a question.
Hi. I think you had a group on this practice of yours, the social reflection you mentioned at the beginning. But I think in relation to the site, how do you mention it in several combinations? How do you choose the site?
So,
the site to do performances or the project?
We do a lot of research, so we go and see a lot of spaces constantly. some of the corporate relationships we ask them to open doors for us and go and look at things that otherwise we wouldn't be able to look at. We ask questions. We usually have one or two projects in mind that we're trying to identify something specific. So, for instance, at the moment we're looking for a series of locations that have sonic resonance and that have a kind of containment and that maybe are completely light tight or that we can make completely controllable as far as light is concerned. So there's a series of phenomena often that we're looking at, and sometimes a site can inform some very sort of early ideas about a piece of work. And that informs how the work develops.
So sometimes the work doesn't exist before, is it more of the site that influences
work? No, something about the work always exists before the site.
Then you know what you're looking for.
The two then start to have dialogue and inform each other. So with Nunhead Cemetery, for instance. We lived 5 minutes from it. We used it regularly, and we suddenly realised that it was...
Question as to what you used it for, really. The unspoken question.
We had used it regularly. So we... and it's a walled cemetery. It's got all sorts of urban myths around it. In the 1960s, apparently, people dug up the corpses and hung them in the trees and took acid and goodness knows what. Anyway, we didn't see any evidence of that. It wasn't us, definitely. But we suddenly realised that it had a lot of the elements we were looking for to make this piece of work called The Baron in the Trees. And the process of getting the licences to use the space took 12 to 18 months, And it wasn't just going to the council and saying, please can do this. It was engaging with a community group that run the cemetery, going to their meetings every month, 12 months, slowly garnering their trust, slowly them understanding what we wanted to do, that had an affinity and met their user group as such. People who were buried there, whose families were buried there, the dog walkers, the young parents that walked their prams around the church, the alcoholics who sit in the graves and drink beer, etc. So it's all about that kind of gentle interface that allows the work then to become like this.
You see that as part of the work?
Yeah.
I think we've come to the end of our time. Thank you very much to me, and what lovely, rich responses. Thank you.